Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic as we continue our deep dive into the big old monster box of baseball cards from the 1980s and early 90s, going year by year, set by set. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and thank you so much for tuning in once again. And we are talking about a legendary set in the baseball card hobby. And it's legendary for a number of reasons. One, you can still find it pretty much everywhere. But two, it is a set that we probably all collected at some point in our lives, whether you are in your, I'd say, early 30s or maybe in your 50s or 60s. Chances are you crossed paths with the 1987 Topps set, a phenomenal set. And when you're talking about phenomenal and legendary, what better person represents both of those terms than Reggie Jackson? Our random pull from that great set. Card number 300, Reggie Jackson. We've had some pretty all-star names here the last, five or six episodes. And Reggie Jackson, we'll talk about his career. Of course, you know a lot about the numbers, but very interesting story about how he got into Major League Baseball. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that great 87 top set. And we'll also talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And we've got plenty of fan reaction, not only to the 87 top set, but also on our most recent podcast about the 87 Fleer set. First, a quick little commercial message, a little housekeeping here. If you follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, you probably saw one or two tweets this past weekend basically notifying you that we are looking for sponsors to help us continue this show for a very, very long time. And I know what you're thinking, Matt, you rat bastard, you're a sellout. Well, yeah, kind of. Actually, in all honesty, the Wax Ecstatic podcast, which we've been doing for a little over 2 months, almost 3 months now, has done very well. And I thank you for that, not only for listening, but for sharing the podcast, sharing our Twitter handle with so many other collectors. And we couldn't have done it without you. Now, it's not like we have 20,000 people listening to this podcast. It is a smaller number, but we are growing. And I can tell you, as a member of the broadcast media and somebody who's been dabbling in podcast and new media over the last few years, there is some significant growth to this podcast, and we're looking to see if there is somebody with a product or service that we should communicate that product or service and what makes it so special to our listeners. Now, I don't want you to think that we're going to be overloaded with commercials. Again, I am a broadcast director. I really don't like 6-minute commercial breaks that you hear on your favorite AM or FM station. We're looking for one or two sponsors to help us along the way. The price point is low, and we do that because the production costs are very low for this show. But if you're listening and you sell a product or you have a particular service, or as the case is quite a few of our followers on Twitter at least, you're a hobby shop owner, you sell baseball cards, or you have a store on eBay, if you think that your product or service could be of interest to our listeners, and because you're a listener of this podcast, chances are they have a lot of the same likes and needs as you do, just send a direct message to us, and then we can continue the conversation there. Now, that's all I want to talk about with sponsorship. You will see the occasional tweet over the next few weeks, just reminding you of this endeavor. Again, we could go completely sponsor-free, and that's fine. But again, there are some small costs to doing this, and I wouldn't mind bringing in a few dollars to cover those costs, while likewise promoting a product or service that we think is a good fit, not only for the Wax Ecstatic podcast, but also for our great, loyal listeners. So thank you for putting up with me for a couple minutes talking about our endeavor to try to bring in a few bucks and let you know about some great services and other card collecting enthusiasts who also listen to Wax Ecstatic and would like to reach out to you. Now, speaking of our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, a lot of action over the past few days. First of all, talking about the 87 Fleer set, which we discussed in our previous podcast, had quite a few people mentioning that they couldn't find Fleer cards back in the day, back in the mid to late 80s, which I find a little odd. Now, granted, I started collecting in 1989, so by then the market was completely flooded. But Fleer was certainly available pretty much everywhere. Of course, hobby shops had it. But if you're looking just at the average grocery store, I recall Fleer, especially the 1990s set and moving forward. And I love the 1990s set, but especially 1990, you can find that in your average grocery store and, you know, the occasional Walmart and Kmart and stores like that. So kind of odd. I know Fleer typically didn't exactly, you know, overproduce cards until the late 80s when they pretty much had to keep up with demand from everybody else. But if you had just Topps and Donruss in your hometown back in 1987, that's not necessarily a bad thing, as they both that year put out some very high quality products. Now, I got an interesting tweet from a Scott Harrison. When we were talking about the 87 Fleer set, he replied, "The set that made me quit collecting." And I followed up with, "Could you tell me why?" And he never got back to me. So I wish I knew. Scott, if you're listening, please do get back to us on Twitter. Let us know why the 87 Fleer set stopped you from collecting cards. I'd be curious to hear what that story is. And I'm not going to say that that makes you a bad person. I'm just really curious. That's very interesting that that particular set just turns you off not only to the set, but the hobby itself, at least for a short amount of time. Meanwhile, Gary Vassar loved that set. Great set. Couldn't beat the powder blue. Love the blue and white border that is featured throughout that set. Also, I love the 3D treatment that Fleer was introducing then. And remember, you know, now here it is, it's 2016. I mean, 3D and sharp graphics and, you know, color grades that go from one shade to another, that is so common and so standard practice now that you forget in 1987, this was way ahead of its time. So I remarked on that in the 87 Fleer set. Matt Flayton sent us a picture of one of his favorite 3D effects. This comes from the 91 Top set with Mark McGwire sliding into third base. Looks like it's either in Detroit or Cleveland, based on the background. Can't really tell. But he's sliding into third base. And if you recall, the 91 Top set had the white border, but then the smaller colored borders, which were color coordinated with their respective teams on the inside. So for Oakland, you had green and gold. And the way that they positioned the photograph, McGwire's right arm, as he's coming in for the slide into the bag, his right arm is in the foreground with the gold and green frame for the A's in the background. So that was very unique 3D effect there, the Topps applied in 1991. By then, you could start seeing more and more of this 3D effect, but I was still blown away by how Fleer managed to do it in 1987. Jason Connor talking about the random poll from our Set That podcast, which was Kent Tekulve playing for the Philadelphia Phillies. Jason says, "More uniforms need zippers." And I totally forgot, of course, if you look at the picture that accompanied our podcast, the Phillies, even back in the late 80s, were still wearing zipper front jerseys. Very unique, because even though while that was common in the 40s and 50s and on some jerseys in the 60s, you know, 1986, which is probably when this photograph was taken, still very unusual, a little bit of a throwback, but I like it. And I know the Phillies last season, or this season, I guess you could say, the season's still going on, although now the teams have advanced to the playoffs. But the Phillies had a throwback game earlier this season, and I was pretty excited about it. Even though I'm not a Phillies fan, I like some of the old, you know, the powder blue and maroon road jerseys that they wore back in the 70s and 80s. But a friend of mine was actually very upset that they didn't replicate the zipper. They were button-down jerseys and not zippers, so it wasn't really a true throwback jersey. Interesting question from Brian Morris. In talking about the 87 top set, as we shift our focus to the set we're talking about this time around, Brian says, what made the 83 set, and this is all tops, by the way, what made the 83 set so crisp and colorful? And sets like 85 and 87 don't look like they're produced by the same company. Now, it's a great question, Brian. I couldn't answer it completely in 140 characters. I gave you a tease. I said, you know, it's really to represent the years. And one of the podcasts that I like to listen to in regards to the hobby is Topps Talk, that is made by the Topps Company. Alex Birch, the host and producer of it, he does an outstanding job. And I remember one episode, he had a designer as a guest, and the designer, I forget his name, unfortunately, but he had been with the organization for probably 30 plus years. He'd been with Topps for a very, very long time. And he said that Topps, every year when designing a card, wanted to make a card that really spoke about that particular year. So there's a feeling of this represents that year, but also making a card that is so unique to where 30 years later you could look back at it or look at a template of it and say, oh yeah, that's from 1983 or that's from 1986 or 1990. You know, you can very easily just look at a basic drawing of that card and you could tell everybody what year it came from. And whether you like Topps designs or not, they did a great job of doing that, of making a card design year after year after year that was very unique. Certainly 87 Topps was, 83 Topps also, as Brian mentioned, 85 Topps, very unique. If you remove photographs and remove, words, team names, player names, positions, team logos, and you just look at the basic shapes of the template, you could very easily as a collector go, that's 83, that's 85, that's 87. Now, more about the 87 Topps set. We asked through a couple of tweets, what was your favorite card and why? Ben Adams says, it's got to be Canseco. He was the man of the day, pre-meds, of course. I remember when that card got up to $100. Yeah, remember when the Canseco card, which was technically his first Topps card, he had an 86 update card, or the Topps traded set, I should say. And that was the big grab card back then. Now, of course, once the early 90s came around, Barry Bonds became the top card. And of course, as Bonds was chasing Mark McGwire's record, and PED use regardless, everybody wanted his card. That, of course, drove the value of that card up. But Canseco was the money card coming right out of the gate there. Now, we've got several other thoughts about what should be the top card in the 87 top set. Jeff Beattie, it's got to be the 87 Future Stars of Bo Jackson. That was the card I was so desperate to find in the 87 Wax Pack. If there was ever, and we'll talk about this when discussing the set as a whole, but if there was ever a card that really represents the excitement of some of the young stars that were playing in Major League Baseball in 1987, it was Bo Jackson. And there he was. I mean, you can close your eyes. You can see the picture. He's in Royal spring training. Looks like he's about to field a fly ball. You've got that Rainbow Future Star logo, which looks a lot like the NBC The More You Know logo at the bottom of the card. And it still resonates to this day. And in fact, Topps in their most recent set, the base set for 2016, they included what they called Berger's Best. Of course, Cy Berger, the guy who really put baseball card design as we know it on the map in the mid-1950s with Topps, they selected one card from each year that represents not only that particular set, but the players who were playing the game then. And Topps selected Bo Jackson. And I opened a pack of Topps and I see that Bo Jackson Future Star. And I got excited. I mean, granted, this is an insert card. Maybe it's worth a dollar. I don't know. But I got excited because I just got that rush from when I was a kid opening up a pack of 87 Topps. Holy crap, I got Bo Jackson. And that's just how much energy that one card from almost 30 years ago, it still carries, even if it's in a facsimile form in the Berger's Best of the 2016 set. So absolutely, Jeff, love that card. CLM Design showing us card number 694. Phil Niekro, how old was he on this card? And Phil Niekro, with the Cleveland Indians here, first of all, he looks like he's about 83. Second, it looks like his arm is about to fall off because Topps got this great picture of Niekro during his delivery. And his arm is actually, if you were to put a clock face on his shoulder joint, his arm is at the 9 o'clock position. I mean, it's pretty interesting that they were able to get him here. But he also looks like a tortoise with the exertion being showed on his face. To answer your question, he was actually 46 at the time. And Niekro would play one more year. He started the 87 season with Cleveland. Had a cup of coffee with Toronto. I totally forgot he was with the Blue Jays. Wrapped up his career with Atlanta. And, his arm quite literally was falling off back in 87. Let's see. Collecting texts. In response to a picture, and we just found a random lot of cards from 87 Tops. One of them was the Turn Back the Clock card, the 1972 Tops with Roberto Clemente. Collectin Text says, I like how on the Turn Back the Clock, Clemente, the centering is off. And he's not talking about the 87 Tops. He's talking about the 72 Tops card that Clemente was on. That was off center, much like a lot of cards in 72. So... good eye there, collecting texts, and he has hashtag realism. Yeah, good luck finding a perfectly centered 72 Tops Roberto Clemente. Let's see, who else here? Oh, Booby Main. That's right, Booby Main selected. He says this one, it's the Todd Worrell 86 record breaker card. And he asks, what is going on with that background? And if you look at the background, I can't tell you. Because it looks like there's some X-ray vision goggles going on in the background, or there was a thermonuclear accident, perhaps in Cincinnati. It looks like the Cardinals are at Old Riverfront Stadium there. But I'm not really sure what's happening in that Worrell picture, but it is rather unique and quite possibly hazardous to your health. GDY Boy Sports says, Buddy Biancalana for sure because of his name. Yes, the legend that is former Kansas City Royals infielder Buddy Biancalana. And while Biancalana has a very memorable name for me and for a lot of fans, if you remember the bit that David Letterman did on Buddy Biancalana, this back when it was Late Night with David Letterman on NBC, this was the 1985 season when everybody was having a Pete Rose hit counter as he was getting closer to Ty Cobb's record. Well, Letterman, in true Letterman fashion, came up with this shtick where they were going to have a Buddy Biancalana hit counter because Biancalana was, let's just put it nicely, not known for his scorching bat. He was a very light-hitting infielder, pretty dependable guy, especially defensively, but definitely a platoon infielder and not a guy who was going to hit 300 by any stretch of the imagination. And the Royals, of course, won the World Series in 85. He had a decent playoff run. And being a good sport, Biancalana actually went on David Letterman's show several weeks after the World Series ended and presented Dave with a game-used bat. And I think the joke was that there were no scuffs on it. So, yeah, Buddy Biancalana, who I think is still working in the Tampa Bay Rays organization and has been for a while. That, of course, a legendary card for numerous reasons. Couple more. Peter Steinberg, number 460, Daryl Strawberry, because it's the first card I can remember hoarding, missed the game-winning RBI as a prominent stat, too. That is very interesting, and it's funny how we get so lost in the sabermetrics and the advanced analytics of the sport today, and it's not just baseball. It happens everywhere else. But if you look at the back of that Daryl Strawberry card, and thank you, by the way, Peter, for sending us a scan of the back there, card number 460, you've got the usual traditional baseball stats, but right beneath it, under the major league totals, there's the game-winning RBI for 1986. He had 15 game-winning RBI. And for the career, he had 42. And what's interesting, you look at Strawberry's career numbers back then. In 86, he had 93 RBI. 15 of them were game-winning. So that is, let me see, how's my math shake out here? That's about 17% of his RBI were game winners in the 86 season, a big reason why the Mets won the World Series that year. And then if you look at his career at that point in time, 343 RBI. Well, he had 42 career RBI. So again, my math may be a little off here, roughly, what, 13%, something like that. So a guy who came through in the clutch. And it's, like I said, it's so funny how we get lost in all of these other stats now. Something as simple as game-winning RBI, featured on the back of a baseball card, very telling about how successful a player could be back in the day. And finally, from Indie Cards Fan, I just pulled this last week from box from Ball Card Exchange, Barry Larkin. And we were talking about Barry Larkin being part of the Reds revival back in the late 80s, of course, winning the World Series in 1990. This kind of dovetails off our podcast on 87 Donruss with Eric Davis as our random pull. Of course, Barry Larkin, a very big factor with that Reds team, and a very cool card that Indy Cards fan was able to pull out of his collection. One final note from our Twitter feed, as we had Ken Kinsley mentioning, again, in response to one of these pictures of just a random assortment of 87 Topps cards, he said, "This was the first season I collected cards. Dale Murphy was his favorite player. Still one of his favorite sets because of the wood card or wood covered border." And I agree, that's one of the great design elements of the 87 Topps card that still stands out. And because Ken tagged Dale Murphy in the tweet there, Dale Murphy is now following us, which is very cool. I'm not somebody who likes to brag about, you know, famous people, you know, following you on Twitter or something, you know, along those lines. But very cool to have Dale Murphy following us at Wax and Gum Stains. And Murph, if you're listening, I was never an Atlanta Braves fan, even though I grew up, spent much of my life here in Florida. But I loved watching Dale Murphy because Murph was one of the few decent players on some not so decent teams, especially in the late 80s. You know, here in Florida, before we got the Rays, and certainly the Miami Marlins, we basically got, and you know, you have to remember too, before ESPN was doing 3-4 games a week, we basically got three baseball teams constantly being forced fed us through the cable system. That was the Cubs on WGN. They weren't that good for much of the 80s. The Mets on WOR. They were, however, fairly good throughout the 80s. And the Braves on Ted Turner's Superstation TBS. And it wasn't just in Florida. A lot of people, early cable converters in the 1980s, you picked up all three of those teams, as well as all three were either owned or heavily sponsored by Superstations who wanted to get the games out all across America. So even though I wasn't a big Braves fan, I was a big Dale Murphy fan, and one of my prized possessions, even though it's a replica, I was able to get a great price on it on eBay, a 1981 Atlanta Braves road jersey, personalized Dale Murphy, and it's not a cheap job. They did it to a T, and I absolutely love wearing it. So Murph, if you're listening, thank you so much for doing that. If not, whoever is assisting you on your Twitter feed, I'm glad that they're following us. You know, all of these tweets and questions and comments about the 87 top set, what more do I need to say about it? You know, normally at this point in the podcast, I'm breaking down the card and I'm talking about the design elements that I like or don't like. 87 Topps has it all. Great photography, great design with the wood border, the fun design too. Like I said, the font that they use, you know, for writing the player's name on the lower third of the card, it looks a lot like somebody just took a Sharpie marker and just scribbled it into a colored box. The logo in the upper left corner, you know, I'm a big fan of baseball logos going anywhere. The fact that they had to angle it too, you know, angles, sharp angles are big in design now, and especially Topps cards. You look at the 2016 set, I've seen previews of the 2017 set. Sharp diagonal angles are very, very popular in graphic design. Well, in 87, they had that, you know, with the cutoff corner, if you will, where the logo was placed in the upper left-hand corner. As I mentioned, great photography, a great set of stars, much like a lot of the 80s sets. You have the early 80s stars, early to mid-80s stars who were becoming stars. You had the veteran stars from the 1970s who still had some power. And the rookie class. We mentioned Barry Bonds. We mentioned Jose Canseco. We mentioned Bo Jackson. Mark McGwire would be another big one from that set. If you go to the Topps traded set, some more gems there. Of course, Greg Maddux, Fred McGriff are in that set as well. So you have a lot of star power, rookie power. And again, you know, if you went out and bought the traded set, you could get the McGriff and Maddux cards along the way. And when you flip the card over to the back, I loved the 87 design on the back, because again, you've got that Sharpie marker kind of writing at the top there where the player name is. You just had a really fun design here with the gray cardstock. You had the yellow back, the blue text, and based on all of the tweets that I was just talking about, this is a set that everybody loves. You know, there are some baseball card sets that you either can take them or leave them. And most of the time you fall into one of those two boats. You either really love a set or you just, whatever. 87 Topps, you either love it or you really love it. I have not met a single person who goes 87 tops. That's such a bad set. Nobody says that. Nobody. And it just goes to show how tops had an absolute winner. And I have to say, in my lifetime, again, I was born in 77. I always loved the 77 set because that was my birth year. I've always had that unique bond to that set. But in my lifetime, my favorite tops set, without a doubt, 87 tops. 83 tops is up there. I also like 91 tops. I like a couple of the sets from, the late 70s and early 80s, but 87 tops, by far, the best set. Now, if you're collecting that set, you already know if you're a collector, there's still plenty of 87 tops that's out there. That's kind of the bad thing. If you're looking to, try to pay off student loans with your massive collection of 87 tops, it's not happening. It flooded the market. There's still plenty out there. So don't buy the 87 top set or don't build an 87 top set to try to make money off of it. You're just not going to. As people just have hordes and hordes of these sets, either factory sets or hand-collated sets. Don't try to sell them. You're not going to make much money. Now, will you make some money off of individual cards like the Barry Bonds rookie? Sure, you can probably make a few dollars if you break open, a wax box and you dig out a few of these individual cards and sell them at a decent price. Sure, you can make a couple bucks, but you are not going to make a mint off this set. And you know what? You probably shouldn't, because if there was a set that is out there that has been overproduced and there's just too much of it out there, but it's okay, it's 87 tops. Because of the design, because of the star power, because, again, at some point in our collecting careers, our paths have crossed and we've all fallen in love with 87 tops. This is just a great set to have. This is a great box of wax packs to tear open and see what you have inside. This is a great set to try to hand collate. I'm still, it's been kind of on a hiatus for 10 or 12 years, but I still have an 87 top set. I'm probably about 30 cards away from completing. There's just something really cool about this set. And if you want to collect it, it's not going to cost you a whole lot of money. You can get sets. Somebody actually tweeted us they got a set for 99 cents on eBay. Well, maybe you can get a great deal on that, but you can get hand-collated sets for $15 to $20. You can get factory sets for around $20. Boxes, not including shipping and handling, if you're buying them like on eBay, you can get for $10 to $15. Again, there's a lot out there, but it's such a fun set. If you don't mind not trying to resell it and make a mint off of it, go ahead and collect a lot of these if you aren't already. And again, this is one of those sets where there's a lot of product out there. It was overproduced. There's still just a lot of it just floating out there in the world or sitting in warehouses somewhere. But as opposed to like 88 Donruss, that's our favorite pinata when it comes to overproduced sets, or some other sets from the late 80s and early 90s, there's something, with 87 tops, you're like, okay, yeah, there's a gazillion of these cards still out there, but it's okay. It's a nice set. I still like collecting it. Now, as for Reggie Jackson, I mean, I don't need to really run down all the stats. I mean, he's a 14-time All-Star, 5-time World Series champion, American League MVP with Oakland back in 73. We all know about the legend that is Mr. October, Reggie Jackson. And like I said, it's just rather fitting that with a legendary set, we pull the card of this living legend, and he is really an outstanding representative of that era in baseball. His pro baseball career started in 1967 with the Kansas City Athletics. In 1968, when the team moved to Oakland, he promptly hit 47 home runs, became one of the biggest stars, and depending on who you ask, a royal pain in the ass with the New York Yankees, helped the Angels get so close to their first World Series. Helped them get into the playoffs in 1982 and 1986, only to have their hearts broken by the Brewers and Red Sox, respectively. And he wrapped up his career in 87 with the Oakland Athletics. So this particular card, it actually, it's rather ironic. We often criticize card companies when they are producing a card that has an outdated photograph. But with Reggie Jackson, You know, it's like, it's okay, because he signed as a free agent with the A's on Christmas Eve of 1986 and managed to complete the 1987 season. Now, as I mentioned, there's a very interesting way that Jackson got to the big leagues, and we'll wrap up our podcast with these thoughts, because a lot of the times you think a big star like Reggie Jackson, he's just automatically a star. You know, it's an easy path to stardom. It's very easy to make that mistake when talking about somebody like the Beatles. You know, people think, oh, the Beatles just showed up on Ed Sullivan one night and there you go. Well, it took a while for the Beatles to get that star status, and it did to Reggie Jackson as well. Growing up in a single-family household, he actually grew up with his dad. A lot of times it's the other way around, where the mom is watching the kids. Well, after a divorce, his dad, Martinez Jackson, raised him. Martinez Jackson was a second baseman for the Newark Eagles of the Negro League. He was also a World War II veteran and a well-known tailor in the suburbs of Philadelphia. That's where Reggie Jackson, grew up. And Reggie Jackson was not just a baseball star in high school. He did everything. Basketball, track and field. He was a stud in football. And in fact, that is what started his professional sports career. Everybody in the colleges around America wanted Reggie Jackson. He was a tailback. They wanted him on their teams, including teams in the South that still in the mid-60s were segregated, including, unfortunately, I have to say this, my alma mater, Alabama, Georgia, Oklahoma, several other schools, but not wanting to grow up in the very racially strained, let's put it nicely, South in the mid-1960s. He went out to Arizona State, actually got there on a football scholarship, and his football coach, Frank Cush, was willing to let him play both football and baseball. And he tried out for the baseball team. Legend is that Jackson was wearing his football gear, faced five pitches in a little bit of a walk-on tryout, hit a home run on the second pitch he saw, and in fact hit three home runs in the five at-bats that he had. And obviously the baseball team's like, well, maybe we should look at him. Now, the NCAA had a rule that didn't allow freshman players, so the baseball team couldn't grab him. Meanwhile, the Baltimore Orioles were trying to grab him, but he didn't want to give up his amateur status, so he decided to decline the Orioles. Can you imagine that? The Orioles going from Frank Robinson and Brooks Robinson and Boog Powell to Reggie Jackson. Now, eventually they got him in 1976 after Charlie Finley traded him from Oakland. But can you imagine Reggie Jackson in his early years playing with the Baltimore Orioles? How many World Series would that team have won? It's a lot of woulda, coulda, shoulda there. That would have been fun. Now, the great whiff of the 1966 Major League Baseball draft. Remember, the draft was only a couple years old then. The New York Mets had the top pick in the draft. They bypassed Jackson. The Mets actually went with a catcher, Steve Chilcott. And even though there were several stories about how certain people in the front office of the Mets were racist and segregationist, the story is more likely that the Mets were just trying to answer a need, and they needed a catcher. So they went with Steve Chilcott. The Kansas City Athletics, they're on deck in number two. They swipe up Jackson, and of course, the rest is history. He stars with Oakland, hits that mammoth shot in the 71 All-Star game in Detroit, wins those three World Series in Oakland in 72, 73, 74. After that trade to Baltimore, signs as a free agent with the Yankees. That's where he earns that Mr. October status with the three home runs, Game 6, 1977 against the Dodgers. Helps the Yankees beat the Dodgers again in 78. And despite numerous off-field run-ins with manager Billy Martin and owner George Steinbrenner, still a legend in New York, wraps up his career with California and Oakland, and today he is part of the Yankees front office. He is still a representative of the Yankees team, has been for about 10 or 12 years now. And according to some reports, he has kind of cleaned up his life a little bit and kind of loosened up a little bit. Again, during the Bronx Zoo days, he was a notorious pain in the ass, to put it very simply. So, that reputation followed him for a very long time, but supposedly he had gotten up with a former NFL player and coach Mike Singletary over the last few years and kind of softened up just a little bit. And according to him, kind of came out of his shell just a little bit, a little less protective and a little more open. And of course, being 70 years old right now, sometimes age kind of mellows somebody out. So supposedly that's the case right now. But Reggie Jackson, our random poll. And I don't know about you, but every time I see Reggie Jackson in an Angels uniform, the first thing I think of, must kill the Queen. Yes, the cameo appearance in Naked Gun. If there's any way for an older guy to mellow, it's playing alongside Leslie Nielsen in a role where in the middle of a playoff game, you know, a one-game playoff to get into the playoffs, Reggie Jackson is charged with trying to kill Queen Elizabeth. One of the great sports cameo appearances in movie history, without a doubt. So there you go, Reggie Jackson, card number 300, our random pull from the legendary, epic 1987 Topps baseball set. I don't need to tell you any more about that set. You love it. You've collected it. Still, despite the fact that there's too much of it out there, you still collect it to this day. And I thank everybody for chiming in with their thoughts about the 87 Topps set and your favorite card from that set. All right, so 1987, we're done with it. We're moving on to 1988. And while 1987 was a great year for the card collecting enthusiast in terms of design of cards and rookies and star power, 88 would be a bit of a different story. All of the card makers took a little bit of a step back in design. They didn't take a step back in production as the market was absolutely flooded. And there was a new kid on the block. We'll take a look at the 1988 score set. That's in our next podcast, which comes your way on Friday via Audio Boom. Follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, tell a friend about our Twitter feed, tell a friend about our podcast, and tell a friend to catch us next time around. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic.